and discussing their plans with her. The only thing they had ever forbidden her from doing was going to Kumasi, land of the Ashanti King, or down into Fantiland. And while she had no use for the coast, no respect for Fanti people, her pride in the Ashanti was great. It was growing every day as word came of the Ashanti soldiers' valiant battles against the British, their strength, their hope for a free kingdom. For as long as she could remember, her parents had made up one excuse after the other. She was too young. Her blood had not come. She was not married. She was never getting married. Abana had begun to believe that her parents had killed someone in Kumasi, or were wanted by the king's guards, maybe even by the king himself. She no longer cared. Abana wiped the seed powder from her face and made her hand into a fist. But before she could use it, her mother came up behind her and snatched her arm. "Enough," she said. Old man had his head down as he walked out of their hut, and when the cool air from outside hit the exposed nape of her neck, Abana started to cry. "Sit down," her mother said, gesturing to the stool her father had just left. Abana did as she was told, and watched her mother, a woman of 65, who looked no older than she herself did, still so beautiful that the village boys whispered and whistled when she bent down to lift water. "Your father and I are not welcome in Kumasi," she said. She was speaking as one speaks to an old woman whose memories, those things that used to be hard-formed chrysalises, had turned into butterflies and flown away, never to return. "I am from Kumasi, and when I was young, I defied my parents to marry your father. He came to get me. He came all the way from Fantiland." Abana shook her head. "Why didn't your parents want you to marry him?" Akosia put one hand on top of hers and began stroking it. "Your father was a—" She stopped, searching for the right words. Abana knew her mother didn't want to tell a secret that was not hers to tell. "He was the son of a big man, the grandson of two very big men, and he wanted to live a life for himself instead of a life that was chosen for him. He wanted his children to be able to do the same. That is all I can say. Go and visit Kumasi. Your father will not stop you." Her mother left the hut in search of her father, and Abana stared at the red clay walls around her. Her father should have been a big man, but he had chosen this. Red clay formed in the shape of a circle, a packed straw roof, a hut so small it fit nothing more than a few tree stump stools. Outside, the ruined earth of a farm that had never earned its title as a farm. His decision had meant her shame, her unmarried, childless shame. She would go to Kumasi. In the evening, once she was certain her parents had gone to sleep, Abana slipped away to Ohene Nyako's compound. His first wife, Methia, was boiling water outside her hut, the steam from the air and the pot making her sweat. "Sister Methia, is your husband in?" Abana asked, and Methia rolled her eyes and pointed toward the door. Ohene Nyako's farms were fruitful every year. Though their village was no more than 2 miles by 2 miles, though there was no one to even call chief or big man. So small were their land and their status, Ohene was well respected. A man who could have done well elsewhere, had he not been born here. "Your wife hates me," Abana said. "She thinks I'm still sleeping with you," Ohene Nyako said, his eyes twinkling with mischief. It made Abana want to hit him. She cringed when she thought of what happened between them. They were only children then, inseparable and mischievous. Ohene had discovered that the stick between his legs could perform tricks. And while Abana's father and mother were out begging for a share of the elders' food, as they did every week, Ohene had showed Abana those tricks. "See," he said, as they watched it lift when she touched it. They had both seen their fathers this way. Ohene, on those days his father went from one wife's hut to the next, and Abana in the days before she got her own hut. But they had never known Ohene's to do the same. "What does it feel like?" she had asked. He shrugged, smiled, and she knew what he felt was a good thing. She was born to parents who let her speak her mind, go after what she wanted, even if that thing was limited to boys. Now she wanted this. "Lie on top of me," she demanded, remembering what she'd seen her parents do so many times. Everyone in the village had always laughed at her parents, saying that Unlucky was too poor to get a second wife. But Abana knew the truth. That on those nights when she had slept on the far side of their small hut, pretending not to listen, she could hear her father whisper, "Okosia, you are my one and only." "We cannot do that until we have had our marriage ceremony," Ohene said, mortified. All children had heard the fables about people who lay together before they had their marriage ceremonies. The far-fetched one about the man whose penises turned into trees while still inside the woman, growing branches into her stomach so that he could not exit her body. The simpler, truer ones about banishment, fines, and shame. Finally, that night, Abana had been able to convince Ohene, and he had fumbled around, thrusting at the entrance until he broke through and she hurt. Thrusting inside. Once. Twice. Then nothing. There was no loud moan or whimper as they had heard escape their father's mouths. He simply left the same way he had arrived. Back then she had been the strong, unshakable one. The one who could talk him into anything. Now Abana stared at Ohene Nyako as he stood broad-shouldered and smirking, waiting for the favor he knew was tugging at her lips. "I need you to take me to Kumasi," she said. It wasn't wise for her to travel alone and unmarried, and she knew her father would not take her. Ohene Nyako laughed, a large and boisterous sound. "My darling, I cannot take you to Kumasi now. It is more than 2 weeks' journey, and the rains will soon be coming. I must tend to my farm." "Your sons do most of the work anyway," she said. She hated when he called her his darling, always spoken in English, as she had taught him when they were children after she'd heard her father say it once and asked him what it meant. She hated that Ohene Nyako should call her his beloved while his wife was outside cooking his evening meal and his sons were outside tending to his farm. It didn't seem right that he should let her walk in shame as he had done all those years, not when she knew by looking at his fields that he would soon have enough wealth for a second wife.
But who supervises my sons? A ghost? I cannot marry you if the yams don't grow. If you have not married me by now, you will never marry me,
Abana whispered, surprised at the hard lump that had so quickly formed in her throat. She hated when he joked about marrying her. Ohene Nyako clicked his tongue and pulled her to his chest.
"Don't cry now," he said. "I will take you to see the Ashanti capital, all right? Don't cry, my darling."
Ohene Nyako was a man of his word, and at the end of that week the two set out for Kumasi, the home of the Asante Hene. Everything felt new to Abana. Compounds were actually compounds, built from stone with 5 or 6 huts apiece, not 1 or 2 at most. These huts were so tall they resurrected the image of 10-foot-tall giants from the stories her mother used to tell. Giants who swooped down to pluck tiny children up from the clay earth when they were misbehaving. Abana imagined the families of giants who lived in the town, fetching water, building fires to boil the bad children in their soups. Kumasi sprawled before them endlessly. Abana had never been to a place where she did not know everyone's name. She had never been to a farm that she could not measure with her own eye, so small was each family's plot. Here, the farmlands were large and luscious and filled with men to work them. People sold their wares in the middle of the town, things she had never seen before, relics from the old days of steady trade with the British and the Dutch. In the afternoon they walked by the Asantehene's palace. It stretched so long and wide she knew it could fit over 100 people, wives, children, slaves, and more. "Can we see the golden stool?" Abana asked, and Oheninyako took her to the room where it was kept, locked away behind a glass wall so that no one could touch it. It was the stool that contained the Sunsun, the soul of the entire Ashanti nation. Covered in pure gold, it had descended from the sky and landed in the lap of the first Asantehene, Osei Tutu. No one was allowed to sit on it, not even the king himself. Despite herself, Abana felt tears sting her eyes. She had heard about this stool her entire life from the elders of her village, but she had never seen it with her own eyes. After she and Oheninyako had finished touring the palace, they exited through the golden gates. Entering at the same time was a man not much older than Abana's father, wrapped in kente and walking with a cane. He stopped, staring at Abana's face intently.
"Are you a ghost?" he asked, almost shouting. "Is that you, James?"
"They said you had died in the war, but I knew that could not be." He reached out with his right hand and grazed Abana's cheek, touching her so long and so familiarly that Oheninyako finally had to remove his hand.
"Old man, can you not see this is a woman? There is no James here."
The man shook his head as if to clear his eyes, but when he looked at Abana again there was only confusion.
"I'm sorry," he said,
before hobbling away. Once he had gone, Oheninyako pushed Abana along, out of the gates, until they were firmly back in the bustle of the city.
"That old man was probably half-blind," he muttered, steering Abana by the elbow.
"Shh," Abana said, though there was no way the man could still hear them. "That man is probably a royal." And Oheninyako snorted.
"If he is a royal, then you are a royal too," he said, laughing boisterously.
They kept walking. Oheninyako wanted to buy new farming tools from some people in Kumasi before they headed back, but Abana couldn't bear the thought of wasting time with people she didn't know when she could be enjoying Kumasi, and so she and Oheninyako parted ways, promising to meet again before nightfall. She walked until the tough skin of her soul started to burn, and then she stopped for a moment, taking solace under the shade of a palm tree.
"Excuse me, Ma. I would like to talk to you about Christianity."
Abana looked up. The man was dark and sinewy, his tree broken or rusty. She couldn't tell which. She took him in but could not place his face among any of the tribes she knew.
"What is your name?" she asked.
"Who are your people?"
The man smiled and shook his head. "It does not matter what my name is or who my people are. Come, let me show you the work we are doing here."
And because she was curious, Abana followed him. He took her to a patch of dirt, a clearing that was waiting, begging for something to be built there so that the city sprawl around it wouldn't seem like a broken circle. At first, Abana could not see much. But then more dark men with unplaceable faces walked over to the clearing carrying tree stumps for stools. Then a white man appeared. He was the first white man Abana had ever seen. Even though everyone whispered that there was white in her father, to her, he had always just looked like a lighter version of herself. Here was the man the villagers really spoke of, the man who had come to the Gold Coast seeking slaves and gold, however he could get them. Whether he stole, whether he lied, whether he promised alliance to the Fantis and power to the Ashantis, the white man always found a way to get what he wanted. But the slave trade had finally ended, and two Anglo-Ashanti wars had passed. The white man, whom they called Abroni, Wicked One, for all the trouble he had caused, was no longer welcome there. And yet Abana saw him, sitting on the stump of a felled tree, talking to the tribeless dark men. "Who is that?" she asked the man next to her. "The white man," he said. "He is the missionary." The missionary was looking at her now, smiling and motioning for them to approach. But the sun was beginning to set, ducking under the palm tree canopies that marked the west side of the city, and Ohene Nyako would be waiting for her. "I have to go," she said, already pulling away. "Please," the dark man said. Behind him the missionary stood up, ready to come after her. "We are trying to build churches throughout the Ashanti region. Please, come find us if you ever need us." Abana nodded, though she was already running. When she got to the meeting spot, Ohene Nyako was buying roasted yams from a bush girl, a girl who, like Abana, had come from some small Ashanti village, hoping to see something new, to change her circumstances. "Hey, Kumasi woman," Ohene Nyako said. The girl had hoisted her big clay pot of yams back onto her head and was walking away, her hips keeping a steady, swaying pace. "You're late." "I saw a white man," she said, pressing her palm against the wall of someone's compound as she tried to steady her breath. "A churchman." Ohene Nyako spit on the ground, sucked his teeth. "Those Europeans, don't they know to stay out of Ashanti? Did we not just beat them in this last war? We don't want whatever it is they are trying to bring us. They can take their religion to the Fantis before we finish them all." Abana nodded absently. The men of her village often spoke of the ongoing conflict between the Ashantis and the British, saying that the Fantis were sympathizers, and that no white man could come into their country and tell them that they no longer owned it. These were village people, farmers who had never seen war, most of whom had never seen the coast of the Gold Coast they so wanted to protect. It was on a night like this that Papa Kwabena, one of the oldest men in their village, had started speaking about the slave trade. "You know, I had a cousin in the north who was stolen from his hut in the middle of the night. Swoosh! Just taken. And we don't know by whom. Was it an Ashanti warrior? Was it a Fanti? We don't know. We don't know where they took him." "To the castle," Abana's father said, and everyone had turned to look at him. Unlucky, who always sat in the back of the village meetings, holding his daughter in his lap as though she were a son. They allowed this because they pitied him. "What castle?" Papa Kwabena asked. "There's a castle on the coast in Fantiland called the Cape Coast Castle. That is where they used to keep the slaves before they sent them away. To Abaratre, America, Jamaica. Ashanti traders would bring in their captives. Fanti, Ewe, or Ga middlemen would hold them, then sell them to the British or the Dutch.
or whoever was paying the most at the time. Everyone was responsible. We all were. We all are. The men all nodded, though they did not know what a castle was, what America was. But they did not want to look foolish in front of Unlucky. Ohene Nyako spit out a burnt portion of the yam and put his hand on Abena's shoulder. "Are you well?" he asked. "I was thinking about my father," she said. A smile broke across Ohene Nyako's face. "Oh, Unlucky. What would he say if he saw you here with me now, eh? His precious son, Abena, doing something he has long forbidden her to do." He laughed. "Well, let me get you to him now." They traveled quickly and quietly, Ohene Nyako and his large, full frame making a way, tearing a path through terrain that had dangers Abena dared not think of. By the end of the second week, they could just make out the skyline of their own village, small though it was. "Why don't we rest here?" Ohene Nyako asked, pointing to a spot just in front of them. Abena could tell that others had rested there before. There was a small cave that had formed from the ruin of fallen trees, and the space on the ground had been cleared to make room for it. "Can't we keep going?" Abena asked. She had begun to feel homesick for her mother and father. She had told them everything from the day she spoke her first word, and she could not wait to tell them about this, even though she knew her father would still be angry. He would want to hear it. Her parents were getting older, and she knew they had no time to harbor bad feelings. Ohene Nyako was already setting his things down. "It's another day's journey," he said, "and I'm too tired, my darling." "Don't call me that," Abena said, dropping her own things to the ground as she sat down in the small tree cave. "But you are." She didn't want to say it. Instead, she wanted to force the words to stay inside her mouth, but could feel them coming up her throat, pressing against her lips. "Then why won't you marry me?" Ohene Nyako sat down next to her. "We've talked about that. I will marry you when I have my next big harvest. My parents always used to say that I shouldn't marry a woman whose clan I didn't know. They said you would bring nothing but dishonor to my children, if we had children at all. But they don't speak for me anymore. I don't care what the villagers say. I don't care if your mother was thought barren until she had you. I don't care that you are the daughter of a nameless man. I will marry you as soon as my land tells me that I am ready to marry you." Abena couldn't look at him. She was staring at the bark on the palm trees, the rounded diamonds criss-crossing against each other, each one different, each one the same. Ohene Nyako turned her chin toward him. "You must be patient," he said. "I have been patient while you married your first wife. My parents are so old that their backs have begun to curve. Soon they will fall like these trees, and then what?" She didn't know if it was the thought of being alone without her parents, or the fact of her present loneliness, but before she could fight them, tears were rolling down her face. Ohene Nyako placed his hands on both of her cheeks and wiped her tears with his thumbs, but they fell quicker than he could sweep them away, and so he used his lips, kissing the salty trail that had begun to form. Soon, her lips were meeting his. They were not the lips she remembered from their childhood, the ones that were thin and always dry because he refused to oil them. They were thicker, a trap for her own lips, her own tongue. Soon they were lying down in the shadow of the cave. Abena took off her wrapper and heard Ohene Nyako suck in his breath, removing his own. At first they just stared at each other, taking their bodies in, comparing them with what they'd known before.
He reached for her, and she flinched, remembering the last time he had touched her. How she had lain on the floor of her parents' hut, staring up at the straw roof, and wondering if there was more to it than that. The pain of it so outweighing the pleasure that she could not understand why it happened in huts across her village, the Ashanti, the world. Now Ohene Nyako pinned her arms down to the hard red clay. She bit his arm and he growled, letting go, until she hugged him back toward her. He moved like he knew the scenes that were playing inside her head, and she let him inside her, and she let herself forget everything but him. When they had finished, when they were sweaty and spent and catching their breath, Abana laid her head against his chest, that panting pillow, his heart drumming into her ear. Abana once spent an entire day fetching water for her father's farm, going to the stream, dipping her bucket in, coming back and filling their basin. It was nearing nightfall, and no matter how much water she got, it never seemed to be enough. The next morning, the plants had all died, withered to brown leaves littering the land in front of their hut. She was only 5 then. She did not understand that things could die, despite one's best efforts to keep them alive. All she knew was that every morning her father watched over the plants, prayed over them, and that each season when the inevitable happened, her father, a man whom she had never seen cry, who greeted each turn of bad luck as though it were a new opportunity, would lift his head high and begin again. And so, that time, she cried for him. He found her in the hut and sat down beside her. "Why are you crying?" he asked. "The plants have all died, and I could have helped them," she said, between sobs. "Abana," he asked, "what would you have done differently if you knew the plants would die?" She thought about this for a moment, wiped her nose with the back of her hand, and answered, "I would have brought more water." Her father nodded. "Then next time, bring more water. But don't cry for this time. There should be no room in your life for regret. If in the moment of doing you felt clarity, you felt certainty, then why feel regret later?" She nodded as he spoke to her, even though she didn't understand his words, because she knew, even then, that he was speaking more for himself. But now, letting her head move in rhythm with Ohene Nyako's breath and heart, the slow trickle of combined sweat that slid between them, she remembered those words, and she regretted nothing. The year Abana visited Kumasi, everyone in her village had a bad harvest. Then the year after, and for 4 more years on top of those, villagers began to move away. Some were so desperate, they even went to the dreaded north, crossing the Volta in search of unclaimed land. Land that hadn't forsaken them. Abana's father was so old he could no longer straighten his back or hands. He could no longer farm. So Abana did it for him, watching as the ruined land spit up death year after year. The villagers were not eating. They said it was an act of penance, but knew it was their only choice. Even Ohene Nyako's once lush lands had turned barren, and so his promise to marry Abana after the next good harvest had been set aside. They continued to see each other. In the first year, before they knew what the harvest would bring, they had done so brazenly. "Abana, be careful," her mother would say in the mornings after Ohene Nyako snuck out of Abana's hut. "This is bad juju." But Abana didn't care. So what if people knew? So what if she got pregnant? Soon enough she would be Ohene Nyako's wife, not just his oldest friend turned mistress. But that year, Oheniniako's plants were the first to spoil, and people scratched their heads, wondering why, until their own plants died, and they said there must be a witch among them. Had the trouble they thought unlucky would bring them been so long delayed? It was a woman named Abba who first saw Oheniniako walking the path back from Abana's hut at the end of the second bad year. "It's Abana," Abba cried at the next village meeting, bursting into the room full of old men, her hand clutching her heaving bosom. "She brought evil to Oheniniako, and that evil is spreading to us all." The elders gathered accounts from Oheniniako and Abana themselves, and then, for the next 8 hours, they debated what to do. It was reasonable that Oheniniako had promised to marry her after the next good harvest. They saw no harm in that. But they could not let the fornication go unpunished, lest the children grow up to think such things were acceptable, lest the more superstitious among them continue to blame Abana for the faults of the land. All they knew was, the woman had to be as barren as the land itself for her to not have conceived. And they knew, too, that if they banished her from the village now, Oheniniako would be too angry to help them get the earth to recover once she had left. Finally, they reached their decision and announced it to all. Abana would be removed from the village when she conceived a child, or after 7 bad years. If a good harvest came before either outcome, they would let her stay. "Is your husband home?" Abana asked Oheniniako's wife on the third day of the 6th bad year. She had walked the short distance as the sky dropped around her, but by the time she got there, it had stopped. Mefia didn't look at her, nor did she speak. In fact, Oheniniako's first wife had not spoken to Abana since the night she fought with her husband, begging him to end his affair, to end their family's shame, and he replied that he wouldn't go back on his word. Still, Abana tried being nice to the woman any chance she could. Finally, after the moment of silence grew too awkward for Abana to bear, she went into Oheniniako's hut. When she saw him, he was packing some things into a small kente cloth sack. "Where are you going?" she asked, standing in the doorway. "I'm going to Osu. They say someone there has brought over a new plant. They say it will grow well here." "And what will I do while you are in Osu? They'll probably kick me out the second you are gone," Abana said. Oheniniako set down his things and lifted Abana into his arms so that their faces were level. "Then they will have to deal with me when I get back." He put her down again. Outside, his children were picking bark from the triapia trees so that they could make chewing sticks to take to Kumasi and sell for food. Abana knew this shamed Oheniniako. Not that his children had found something useful to do, but that they had done so because of his inability to feed them. They made love quickly that day, and Oheniniako set out shortly after. Abana went home to find her parents sitting in front of a fire, roasting groundnuts. "Oheniniako says there is a new plant in Osu that is growing very well. He is gone to get it and bring it back to us." Her mother nodded. Her father shrugged. Abana knew she had shamed them. When the pronouncement of her future exile was made, her parents had gone to the elders to try to reason with them, to make them reconsider. At that time, and still, Unlucky was the oldest man in the village. Deference was still owed, even if he wasn't allowed to be an elder because he wasn't originally from the village. "We have only one child," Old Man had said, but the elders just turned their heads. "What have you done?" Abana's mother asked her at dinner that night, crying into her hands before lifting them up to the heavens. "What have I done to deserve this child?" But at that point, only 2 bad years had gone by, and Abana assured them that the plants would grow, and Ohene Nyako would marry her. Now the only solace was the fact that it seemed Abana had inherited her mother's supposed barrenness, or old man's family's curse, or whatever it was that kept her from conceiving a child.
"Nothing will grow here," old man said. "This village is finished. No one can keep living like this. No one can take one more year eating nothing but nuts and tree bark. They think they are exiling just you, but really this land has condemned us all to exile. You watch. It's only a matter of time."
Ohene Nyako came back a week later with the new seeds. The plant was called Koko, and he said it would change everything. He said that Akyapem people in the eastern region were already reaping the benefits of the new plant, selling it to the white men overseas at a rate that was reminiscent of the old trade.
"You don't know how much these little seeds cost me," Ohene Nyako said, holding them in his palm so that everyone around him could see and feel and smell them. "But it will be worth it for the village, trust me. They will have to stop calling us the Gold Coast and start calling us the Cocoa Coast." And he was right. Within months, Ohene Nyako's cocoa trees had sprouted, bearing their gold and green and orange fruit. The villagers had never seen anything like it, and they were so curious, so eager to touch and open the pods before they were ready, that Ohene Nyako and his sons had taken to sleeping outside so that they could keep watch. "But will this feed us?" the villagers wondered after they had been shooed away by the children, or yelled at by Ohene Nyako himself.
Abena saw less and less of Ohene Nyako in those first few months of his cocoa farming, but the absence comforted her. The harder he worked on the farm, the sooner his harvest would be good, and the sooner the harvest was good, the sooner they could marry. On the days she did see him, he would speak of nothing other than the cocoa, and what it had cost him. His hands smelled of that new smell, sweet and dark and earthy. And after she had left him, she would continue to smell it on the places he had touched, the full dark circles of her nipples or just behind her ears. The plant was affecting them all. Finally, Ohene Nyako said that it was time for the harvest, and all the men and women from the village came to do as he instructed, as he had been instructed by the farmers in the eastern region. They cracked open the cocoa fruit to find the sweet white pulp that surrounded the small purple beans, and placed the pulpy beans on a bed of banana leaves, then covered them with more leaves. After that, Ohene Nyako sent them home.
"We can't live off of this,"
the villagers whispered as they walked back to their houses. Some of the families had already started packing up their huts, discouraged by what they had seen inside the cocoa pods. But the rest of them came back after 5 days to spread the fermented beans in the sun so that they would dry. The villagers had each donated their kente sacks, and once dry, the cocoa beans were packed into these sacks. "Now what?" they asked each other, glancing around as Ohene Nyako put the sacks into his hut.
"Now we rest," he announced to the group waiting outside.
"Tomorrow, I will go to the trading market and sell what I can." He slept in Abana's hut that night, as brazenly and openly as if they had been married for 40 years or more, and this gave Abana hope that soon they would be. But the man beside her on the floor was not the confident man who had promised an entire village redemption. In her arms, The man she had known since before they wore cloth to cover their loins trembled.
"What if this doesn't work?
What if I can't sell them?" he asked, his head buried in her bosom.
"Shh! Stop that talk," she said. "They will sell. They have to sell."
But he kept crying and shaking so that she could not hear him when he said, "I'm afraid of that, too." And she would not have understood, even if she had. He was gone by the time she woke up the next morning. The villagers had found and killed a scrawny young goat in preparation for his return, cooking the tough meat for days as best they could, in the hope that it would turn tender. The younger children, thinking they were fast and clever, would try to snatch small pieces of partially cooked meat from the animal when their mothers weren't looking. But the women, born with a sixth sense for children's mischief, would swat their hands, then clutch them at the wrists, holding them over the fire until the children cried out and swore to behave. Ohene Nyako did not come back that night, or the next. He came back in the afternoon of the third day. Behind him, being led by a rope, were four fat and obstinate goats, bleating, as though they could smell the iron of the slaughter knife. The sacks he had carried out, full of cocoa beans, had come back to them filled with yams and kola nuts, some fresh palm oil, and plenty of palm wine. The villagers threw a celebration the likes of which they had not thrown in years, with dancing and shouting and bare jiggling breasts. The old men and women danced the adwa, lightly swaying their hips and bringing their hands up and over, as though ready to receive from the earth and then give back to her. Their stomachs had grown smaller, it seemed, and so the food they ate filled them quickly, and they filled the crevices that were left between the food with sweet palm wine. Unlucky and Okosia were so happy the bad years had finally ended that they held each other close, watching the others dance, watching the children drum against their full bellies in time with the music. In the middle of all the celebration, Abana looked over at Ohene Nyako as he surveyed the people of the village they all loved so fiercely, his face full of pride, and something she couldn't quite place.
"You've done well," she said, approaching him.
He had kept his distance all night, and she thought it was because he didn't want to draw attention to the two of them in the middle of the celebration. Didn't want the villagers to start wondering what this meant for Abana's exile. But the meaning was all Abana was able to think about. She had not told anyone yet, but she was 4 days late. And though she had been 4 days late before in her life, and imagined that she would be 4 days late again before she died, she wondered if this time was the time. What she wanted was for Ohene Nyako to shout his love for her from the rooftops, to say now that the whole village has been fed and feted. "I will marry you. And not tomorrow, but today, this very day. This celebration will be for us." Instead, he said,
"Hello, Abina.
Did you get enough to eat?"
"Yes, thank you."
He nodded and drank from a calabash of palm wine.
"You have done well, Ohene Nyako," Abina said, reaching out to touch his shoulder. But her hand grazed nothing but air. He wouldn't meet her eyes.
"Why did you move?" she asked, stepping away from him.
"What?"
"Don't say what, like I am crazy. I tried to touch you and you moved."
"Quiet, Abina. Don't make a scene."
She didn't make a scene. Instead, she turned and began walking, walking past the people dancing, past her parents crying, walking, until she found the floor of her hut and lay down upon it, one hand clutching her heart, and the other clutching her stomach. This was how the elders found her the next day when they came to announce that she could remain in the village. The bad years had ended before her 7th year of adultery, and she had not yet conceived a child. And, they said, Ohene Nyako's harvest had been so profitable that now he could finally fulfill his promise. "He will not marry me," Abana said from her spot on the floor, rolling this way and that, one hand on her stomach, the other on her heart, holding the two places that hurt. The elders scratched their heads and looked at each other. Had she finally gone mad from all the years of waiting?
"What is the meaning of this?"
one of the elders asked. "He will not marry me," she repeated, and then she rolled away, giving them nothing more than her back. The elders rushed over to Ohene Nyako's hut. He was already preparing for the next season, preparing and separating the seeds so that he could pass out a share to all of the other village farmers.
"So she has told you," he said.
He didn't look up at the elders, just continued to work on the seeds. One pile for the Sarpongs, one for the Jessies, one for the Asaris, another for the Kankams.
"What is this about, Ohene Nyako?"
He had made all of the piles, and in the afternoon, the head of each family would come to collect them, spread them into their own small plots of land, and wait for the strange new trees to grow and flourish so that soon the village would be restored to what it once was, or surpass it. "To get the cocoa plants, I had to promise a man in Osu that I would marry his daughter. I will have to use all of the leftover goods from my cocoa trade to pay her bride price. I cannot marry Abana this season. She will have to wait." From her hut, where Abana had finally risen off the hard ground and dusted off her knees and back, she knew she would not wait. "I'm leaving, old man," Abana said. "I can't stay here and be made a fool of. I have suffered enough." Her father blocked the exit of the hut with his body. He was so old, so frail, that Abana knew she had only to touch him and he would fall. The path would clear, and she could make her way on.
"You can't leave yet," he said. "Not yet."
He slowly backed out of the doorway, watching to see if she would stay. When she didn't move, he picked up his shovel, went out to a spot on the edge of their land, and started digging.
"What are you doing?"
Abana asked. Unlucky was sweating. He moved so slowly, Abana took pity on him. She took the shovel and began to dig for him.
"What are you looking for?" she asked.
Her father got down on his knees and started raking away the dirt with both of his hands, holding it a while, then letting it sift through his fingers. When he stopped, all that was left in his palms was a black stone necklace. Abana sank down beside him and looked at the necklace. It shimmered gold and was cool to the touch. Her father huffed loudly, trying to catch his breath.
"This belonged to my grandmother, your great-grandmother, Ephia. It was given to her by her own mother."
"Ephia," Abana repeated. It was the first time she had heard the name of one of her ancestors, and she savored the taste of the name on her tongue. She wanted to say it again and again. "Ephia, Ephia."
"My father was a slaver, a very wealthy man. When I decided to leave Fantiland, it was because I did not want to take part in the work my family had done. I wanted to work for myself. I see how these townspeople call me unlucky, but every season I feel lucky to have this land, to do this honorable work, not the shameful work of my family. When the villagers here gave me this small bit of land, I was so happy that I buried this stone here to give thanks."
"I won't stop you if you want to go,"
But please, take this with you. May it serve you as well as it has served me. Abana put on the necklace and hugged her father. Her mother was in the doorframe, watching them out in the dirt. Abana got up and hugged her mother too. The next morning, Abana set out for Kumasi, and when she arrived at the missionary church there, she touched the stone at her neck and said thank you to her ancestors. Part 2 H. It took 3 policemen to knock H down, 4 to put him in chains. "I ain't done nothing," he shouted once they got him to the jail cell, but he was speaking only to the air they had left behind. He'd never seen people walk away so quickly, and he knew he had scared them. H rattled the bars, certain that he could bend or break them if only he tried. "Stop that, for they kill you," his cellmate said. H recognized the man from around town. Maybe he'd even sharecropped with him once on one of the county farms.
"Can't nobody kill me," H said.
He was still pressing on the bars, and he could hear the metal start to give between his fingers. Then he could feel his cellmate's hands on his shoulder. H turned around so quick the other man didn't have time to move or think before H had him lifted by the throat. H was over 6 feet tall, and he had the man so high up his head brushed the top of the ceiling. If H lifted him any higher, he would have broken through.
"Don't you touch me again," H said.
"You think them white folks won't kill you?"
the man said, his words coming out small and slow.
"What I done?" H said.
He lowered the man to the ground and he fell to his knees, gasping up long sips of breath.
"Say you was studying a white woman."
"Who say?"
"The police. Heard him talking about what to say before they went out to get you." H sat down next to the man.
"Who they say I was talking to?"
"Cora Hobbs."
"I wasn't studying no Hobbs girl,"
H said, his rage lit anew. If there were rumors about him and a white woman, he would have hoped it would be someone prettier than his old sharecropping boss's daughter.
"Boy, look at you,"
his cellmate said, his gaze so spiteful now that H grew suddenly, inexplicably afraid of the smaller, older man.
"Don't matter if you was or wasn't. All they gotta do is say you was. That's all they gotta do. You think 'cause you all big and muscled up, you safe?"
"No. Them white folks can't stand the sight of you, walking round free as can be. Don't nobody want to see a black man look like you walking proud as a peacock, like you ain't got a lick of fear in you."
He rested his head against the cell wall and closed his eyes for a second.
"How old you was when the war ended?"
H tried to count back, but he'd never been very good at numbers, and the Civil War was so long ago that the numbers climbed higher than H could reach.
"Not sure. About 13, I reckon," he said.
"Mm-hmm. See, that's what I thought. You was young. Slavery ain't nothing but a dot in your eye, huh? If nobody tell you, I'ma tell you. War may be over, but it ain't ended."
The man closed his eyes again. He let his head roll against the wall this way, then that. He looked tired, and H wondered how long he'd been sitting in that cell.
"My name's H,"
he finally said, a peace offering.
"H ain't no kind of name,"
his cellmate said, never opening his eyes.
"It's the only one I got," H said.
Soon the man fell asleep. H listened to him snore, watched the rise and fall of his chest. The day the war ended, H had left his old master's plantation and began to walk from Georgia to Alabama. He'd wanted new sights and sounds to go with his newfound freedom.
He was so happy to be free. Everyone he knew was just happy to be free. But it didn't last long. H spent the next 4 days in the county jail. On the second day, the guards took his cellmate away. He didn't know where. When they finally came for H, the guards wouldn't tell him what the charge was, only that he had to pay the $10 fine by the end of the night.
"I only got $5 saved," H said.
It had taken him nearly 10 years of sharecropping to put away that much.
"Maybe your family can help," the chief deputy said, but he was already walking away, on to the next person. "Ain't got no family,"
H said to no one. He had made the walk from Georgia to Alabama by himself. He was used to being alone. But Alabama had turned H's loneliness into something like a physical presence. He could hold it when he went to bed at night. It was in the handle of his hoe, in the puffs of cotton that floated away. He was 18 when he met his woman, Etha. By then he'd gotten so big that no one ever crossed him. He could walk into a room and watch it clear as men and women made way for him. But Etha always stood her ground. She was the most solid woman he'd ever met, and his relationship with her was the longest he'd had a relationship with anyone at all. He would have asked her for her help now, but she hadn't talked to him since the day he called her by another woman's name. He had been wrong to cheat on her, wronger still to lie. He couldn't call Etha now, not with this shame hanging over him. He'd heard of black women coming to the jailhouse to look for their sons or husbands and being taken into a back room by the policemen, told that there were other ways to pay a fine.
No, H thought. Etha would be better off without him.
By sunrise the next morning, on a sweltering July day in 1880, H was chained to 10 other men and sold by the state of Alabama to work the coal mines just outside of Birmingham. "Next," the pit boss shouted, and the chief deputy shoved H in front of him. H had been watching them check each of the 10 men who'd been chained to him on the train ride there. H wasn't even sure he could call some of the men. He saw a boy, no older than 12, shivering in the corner of the train. When they'd pushed that boy in front of the pit boss, he'd peed himself, tears running down his face all the while, until he looked like he himself would melt down into the puddle of wet at his feet. The boy was so young, he'd probably never seen a whip like the one the pit boss had laid out on his desk, only heard about them in the nightmarish stories his parents told.
"He's a big one, ain't he?"
the chief deputy said, squeezing H's shoulders so that the pit boss could see how firm they were. H was the tallest, strongest man in the room. He'd spent the whole train ride trying to figure out a way to break his chains. The pit boss whistled. He got out of his chair and circled H. He grabbed H's arm, and H lunged at him before his shackles stopped him. He hadn't been able to break the chains, but he knew if his hands could only reach, it wouldn't take him but a second to snap the pit boss's neck.
"Woo-hoo!" the pit boss said. "Looks like we'll have to teach this one some manners. How much you want for him?"
$20 a month," the deputy said.
"Now you know we don't pay more than 18, even for a first-class man. You said yourself he's a big one. This one will last you a while, I bet. Won't die in the mines like the others."
"Y'all can't do this," H shouted. "I'm free," he said. "I'm a free man."
"No," the pit boss said.
He looked at H carefully and pulled out a knife from the inside of his coat. He began to sharpen the knife against an ironstone he kept on his desk.
"No such thing as a free nigger."
He walked slowly up to H, held the sharpened knife against his neck so that H could feel the cold, ridged edge of it, begging to break skin.
The pit boss turned to the chief deputy.
"We'll give you 19 for this one," he said.
Then he ran the tip of the knife slowly across H's neck.